Good.
Yeah, our speaker today is a distinguished biophysicist. John Wichtel is the A.B. Lerner Professor of Living State Physics at the University. And an aside, side remark to you young people, if you're planning to get a chair professorship, you should choose a donor with a last name of Lerner and Pellet. John received his PhD at Stanford University from the late Bill Fairbanks, and has since then made many important contributions to living state physics. As announced in the abstract, Professor Wichtel has kindly agreed to give some practical advice on how to extend your heart to beyond the mean failure time of 2 billion cycles. So, John?
Okay. Thank you, Tony. Thank you very much for the invitation to speak today. Tony asked me to give a general interest talk on the kinds of things I'm interested in. So what I'm going to do is give a talk on cardiac electrophysiology as viewed by a physicist. So cardiac electrodynamics, just how does your heart work and not. So I'll start by reviewing cardiac physiology, describe what is known classically as the forward and inverse problems, and describe what I consider the ultimate forward and inverse problems, and then open the floor to questions about, as Tony says, how to extend your heart beyond the mean time. So this is a picture of the heart wrapped in a fibrous sheath surrounded by lungs, which have been carefully pulled away. From the point of view of a physicist, the heart is a biochemically powered, electrically activated, pressure and volume regulated, two-stage tandem mechanical pump with a mean time to failure of approximately 2 billion cycles. When I was a graduate student, I did the calculation and came up with 10 of the ninth cycles. And when I turned 30, or 35, I redid the calculation and decided we had to add a significant figure. So, from the point of view of the plumbing, I said it's a tandem heart. It has a right side and a left side. It's two-stage in that it has a low-pressure reservoir and kind of a pre-injection chamber, the atria, the ventricle that does the majority of the work for both, so you have two sides of the heart. So the way the circulation works is that blood comes from the lungs at low pressure, goes into the lungs, comes back from the lungs, goes into the left side of the heart. It's then, I got an arrow wrong here. No, comes from, I'm sorry. Comes from, starting this story at the wrong place. Comes in from the body as blue blood, goes out to the lungs, is converted into red blood, goes out into the left heart as injected at high pressure into the aorta, where it goes up to the brain, down to the rest of the body. Something on the order of 5% of the output of the heart is used to power the heart itself. So in terms of a pump, it's fairly simple. You have the right side of the heart, low pressure, 3 millimeters of mercury going in, 20 millimeters of mercury going out. On the left side, 7 millimeters coming from the lungs and high pressure going out. The kinds of problems that interest physicians are ones of control, because you have two serial pumps and two series resistors. And if the two pumps pump at different rates, you can either drain the lungs of blood or fill them up with blood. And that's a classic situation in cardiac failure, where you start accumulating too much fluid in one side of the circuit than the other. But it's a very, very clever balancing control system to keep those two independent pumps pumping at the same rate. Since it's a pulsatile pump, what you have is fluctuations in pressure, the low pressure being the diastolic or the relaxed, the dilated heart, systolic at the high pressure when it's contracted. And this pressure pulse propagates through the system. It's very prominent in the aorta, smaller in the arteries. The majority of the peripheral resistance that is leading to the pressure drop occurs in what are called the arterioles. That's before the capillaries. The pressure drop is not in the capillaries because you'd blow them out. So the fluctuations in velocity are very high in the aorta, damped down. By the time you get to the capillaries, there are very few fluctuations in velocity, if at all. And as you return back towards the heart, you find fluctuations again just because you're suddenly emptying the great vessels as the blood enters the heart in a pulsatile manner. So the way the cycle works is the four chambers of the heart, everything is relaxed, blood is flowing into the right atrium, into the left atrium, passively fills the ventricles. The atria contract, they don't have valves, so they send a little bit of blood backwards, that's no big deal. But they do send blood into the ventricles, and at high heart rates, like when you're running, that's a substantial fraction of ventricular filling comes from this. Then the ventricles contract, and when the ventricles contract, the pressure rises. As soon as the pressure rises, these two valves snap closed. The pressure continues to rise, and when the pressure is greater than the pressure in the aorta or in the pulmonary artery, that valve pops open. The blood flows out to the appropriate parts of the body. When the contraction stroke is finished, the heart relaxes, the pressures drop, all four valves shut, and the volume of the heart is fixed, its shape changes slightly, and then when the pressures are low enough, these valves pop open and the cycle begins again. Now, as I said, the something like 5% of the cardiac output is going to power the heart itself. This is I believe a dog heart that had the coronary arteries injected with plastic and then the dog was dissolved. And what's sobering about this is when you look at the heart and see how much of the heart is plumbing internally, where this is one of the main coronary arteries, and if one of those gets blocked, this region of tissue is not perfused and then dies and you have a heart attack. Now, the cycle is again, I mentioned, we're not going to go into it in length, but there's all sorts of clever timing that's been worked out in detail probably 50 years ago, where you have the atria contracting, producing an electrical signal. The ventricles contract, give you a very large electrical signal. The ventricles relax, and you get a broader electrical signal. So the volume of the left ventricle rises until it starts to contract and you eject. At the time it's contracting, you have pressures rising. When the valves open, the pressures in the aorta rise. There are all sorts of clever, this little bump here is probably an acoustic reflection from sending a wave down a tapered elastic tube, which has all sorts of nice wave properties. And this is the left side of the heart, this is the right side of the heart. You can hear all sorts of different sounds. From my point of view, the part that I'm interested in is the electrical behavior. I said it was electrically powered, electrically activated. There's a relaxation oscillator called the SA node that fires at the resting heart rate because of an unstable potential of a small group of cells. When they fire, they stimulate the atria and an electrical signal propagates to the AV node. The AV node is a delay line. It provides a directional block. It also provides a overdrive that if your atria are going too fast, they won't keep up so that you can't overdrive the ventricles if you have an atrial problem. They have a number of neat features, and it's just done through special morphology of cells. The trouble is that the electrical activity is starting here, and when the heart contracts, this, with the simple picture, the heart would contract from the top down, but the openings are at the top of the heart, not the bottom. So you don't want the heart to contract from the top down and squeeze the blood to the bottom of the heart. You want the heart to squeeze from the bottom up. So you have a wiring system, the bundle of His and Purkinje system, that is designed that the activation goes from here very quickly down to the tip of the heart and then has a propagating wave that we'll see in just a second. Each of these events has a different electrical signal, and when you combine all of these up, weighted by the volumes of the tissue, from the outside you see the classic electrocardiogram. Now, this is the first clinical electrocardiograph machine, and it was built by Einthoven, who was a physicist. The parts are kind of cute. This is an arc lamp. This is a string galvanometer that used a carbonized string and a strong magnetic field. It was the first device that had the frequency response to be able to measure signals that were had durations of a fraction of a second or in the tens to hundreds of milliseconds. This is a chopped wheel. It's a wheel that's a chopper that gives the timing marks. And this is what's called a falling plate camera. You simply drop your photographic plate past the experiment, and as it falls, it records the signal, and it probably drops into the developer. The big problem was the electrodes, and you had an electrode for the right arm, an electrode for the left arm, and an electrode for the foot, and they were just buckets filled with sulfuric acid. Now, it made good contact, and then. So this is 1911 or so. So things have gotten to the point where you can now go to the store and buy yourself one of the, actually you can get one of these things with a polar heart rate monitor that's effectively this device on your wrist. So again, you record the electrocardiogram and you record a pressure signal that goes by it, and this is the plumbing side and I worry about the electrical side. Now, it turns out that if you put an electrocardiogram on a person, such as in the Einthoven machine, you'd record an electrocardiogram that shows nice rhythmic behavior. And this was actually done on a dog, and it was done by a cardiologist friend of mine in an experimental, I think this was a dog, could have been a person, they both work. You stimulate the heart and you get what's called a tachycardia, and we'll see an example of a rhythm or pattern of activation that causes a tachycardia. And then the tachycardia becomes much faster and decays into fibrillation. Actually, here's the tachycardia. You shock it a second time, the tachycardia becomes disorganized fibrillation at a very much higher frequency, very much more complicated. And then you put a defibrillation shock and return to normal rhythm. So this would be the event of a heart attack. You're in normal rhythm, you enter into a tachycardia. The tachycardia degenerates into fibrillation, where you have what's effectively vortex shedding of wave fronts crossing boundaries. And then, through some intervention or rare good luck, your heart is defibrillated. There were three different things, and this was an experiment. So this was either a dog in the dog lab or a person in the clinical electrophysiology lab. You have multiple stimuli that are running at faster than the normal rate. These lines are going to be stimuli. So you've increased the heart rate. That has triggered, and we'll see more about this in a little bit, a reentrant rhythm where the heart is now, instead of going from atria to ventricles, the ventricles are talking to themselves. It turns out that a shock was given, and it turns out that this tachycardia went even faster. And then when it went sufficiently fast, it broke down from a very simple wave into a very complicated wave, effectively through vortex shedding. So the analogy would be this becomes turbulent. And this was allowed to go for some number of seconds, and then a shock was applied with defibrillation electrodes. And that shut the entire heart down, and it restarted on its own at a regular rhythm. Okay? Normally with a heart attack, this would go continually and then would stop. It could be spontaneous. It can be spontaneous. Okay, I mean, that's kind of a scary thing. The system is intrinsically unstable. If you ever get it into this state, the odds of getting to this are even greater. But any normal heart can probably be converted from this state to that state with the appropriate intervention. If you stick your finger in the wall socket the wrong way, you can do that yourself. Okay, and that therein lies the problem, is you have a system that really has very high gain, and it can go unstable. Yes. I wouldn't say 100%, but quite high. I mean, the people upon whom this experiment is done are quite ill. This experiment is not done on the normal person on the street. This is someone who has, if this was a person, I think this was a dog, but if this was a person, it would be someone who had a life-threatening arrhythmia, and they were trying to figure out how to correct it. And the only way they could correct it is to create it. And the only way to create it is to go into the clinical cardiac lab, create it, and then stop it. And if you have an implantable defibrillator installed, they have to know where to set the threshold on the defibrillator. But in general, I think the odds are very, very high that they can stop it in the laboratory. The problem is when you're on the street, the odds of stopping it are much lower. Okay. Okay? Now, whoops, sorry, don't touch that one. I'll back this one up for a second. It turns out the inverse problem is given an electrocardiogram like the one we saw there. The question is, what in the world is going on inside the heart? And so, as an example of the inverse problem, it's where you try to determine an effective source from surface potentials. It could be for the electrocardiogram, the magnetocardiogram, the electroencephalogram, the magnetoencephalogram, or the magnetointerogram from the intestines. You are taking a remote potential or magnetic field and trying to infer the sources. And it turns out that that is not terribly easy to do. We're going to talk more about it. But before we do the inverse problem, I want to talk about the forward problem. And the forward problem is going to be, how do you predict the signals that we saw on the previous slide from a description of the sources? Now, do you know what the sources look like, predict the signals? That's the first step in a closed loop where you want to then take the signals and come back. You want to estimate the effects of various conductivities on signals, and if you want to look at how coupled oscillators in the intestines are working. The kinds of questions that you would ask with the pair of forward and inverse problems is, why does it take less than a joule of energy to fibrillate the heart and as much as 100 joules of energy to defibrillate it? Okay, yeah. Yeah, the next one. Okay, so now to do the forward problem, we have to look at what the sources are. A cardiac cell is on the order of 100 microns long, 10 or 20 microns in diameter. It has a membrane that's 70 angstroms thick, so the scale is way off. The resting cell has an excess of negative charge on the inside, positive charge on the outside. You can stick a micropipette, a very small glass microelectrode, into the cell, connect it to a high impedance amplifier, and find that the inside is minus 70 millivolts relative to the outside. If you stick a second electrode into the cell and inject some current, you can trigger the nonlinear response that says, I've injected this current, and the net result is that charge starts flowing out and in. This inrush of charge flows forward, it changes the polarity on the membrane, and you have a propagating reaction that's equivalent to a flame moving down a candle, or moving along a candle. So if I put a stimulus in, stimulus current, I get a voltage response about 100 millivolts, a rise time of a millisecond, and it can propagate throughout the entire heart. Now, cardiac tissue, as I said before, is neat because it allows the propagation of these signals. We showed the picture of the heart that had these Purkinje fibers that activate the inner surface 30 milliseconds into the excitation of the ventricles. You have a hemispherical wavefront that is a millimeter thick. It has a 100 millivolt change in the voltage across the cardiac cells. Current is being squirted out the outer surface, being sucked in on the inner surface, and this current is then causing the next adjacent tissue to become activated. So 10 milliseconds later, the wavefront has moved. And this wavefront is a moving three-dimensional battery. If you look at, for example, one of the early pages in Jackson, or at least the edition when I took it, the wavefront can be thought of as a uniform double layer where you have charge ejected from this surface of equal amplitude to the charge being sucked in on the other side. The thickness is constant, and as soon as you have that, the source is a uniform double layer, and the solid angle theorem applies. It says the voltage at this point is determined solely by the solid angle subtended by the rim of this activation wavefront. What makes that so terribly sad is you have all this beautiful geometry of wavefront in the heart that's reflecting the physiology of whether or not you're intact, your heart is completely well or not. You're putting an electrocardiogram electrode here, and the only thing the electrode sees is the solid angle subtended by the outermost rim of this part and the outermost rim of that part. So all of the topology that you can imagine, perturbations going out and in of these wavefronts, is washed out. And that's a direct consequence of these potentials obeying Laplace's equation. And that's just one of the great sad things in this whole business, is that the potential at this point reflects only the boundary of the source and not the source itself. So, the historical approach to this, starting in the probably 1920s, was to treat the heart as an electric dipole, and that's why the electrocardiogram was set up with, because of the convenient limbs, one leg was ground, one leg was for one electrode, and you had your arms for the other two electrodes. They came up with a triangular coordinate system and measured the electrical dipole moment of the heart in two dimensions. Then they went to the uniform double layer model, which we just showed, and bidomain models, which I'll talk a little bit about tomorrow for those that are interested. Hodgdon-Huxley models are the truly nonlinear models of initially for nerve propagation, and that has evolved to what are called patch clamp and single channel kinetics. So the models started out with the scale of the whole body, and as we'll see in a minute, have gone down to the scale of microns and nanometers. Now, again, you use these models because you're trying to go either forwards or backwards or both. So I would like to define what I call the ultimate inverse problem. And the ultimate inverse problem is to try to take a global behavior of the body, for example, the electrocardiogram, and say, can I understand the cellular mechanisms and specific things going on at the ion channel that are associated with what I see on the surface of the body? So can I look at the electrocardiogram and figure out what's happening at the level of the particular channel? That is a impossibly hard problem, but it's a good question to ask to put things in perspective. Now, in the inverse problem, we're going to go from the surface of the body in towards the channel, in towards the heart, and see what we see. So we'll start with a movie. We start 10 kilometers over Chicago. We're now a kilometer over Chicago. We're now 100 meters over Soldier's Field. We're 10 meters over Soldier's Field, 1 meter over Soldier's Field. We make a small incision. Now at the scale of 10 centimeters, and in fact we've changed the scales because now 10 centimeters is the diameter of the heart. This is actually a cardiac valve, but this is the diameter of the heart. Now that we're inside the body, we can keep going. At the scale of 1 centimeter, you have the thickness of the wall of the heart. That's extremely important because there are these very large pressure gradients and you have to support them 2 billion times. Next slide. At the scale of a millimeter, the architecture is really quite fascinating because the fibers of the heart have to support this mechanical contraction where you're squeezing at high pressure to get the blood out of the heart, but there's nothing to hold on to. It's not as if you were taking two plates and squeezing them together or any other kind of pump. So what you have is a ring of connective tissue, fibrous ring of connective tissue, and the cardiac fiber, which is a strand of cells, each of which is 100 microns in length, 10 microns in diameter, that may or may not be grouped together in bundles, start here, wrap around in a very beautiful topology, come back around and attach to the tendons that hold the valves. So you have this valve that's going flap, 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 and you don't want the valves to blow out. So in fact, what happens is when the heart contracts, which means all of these fibers get shorter, these fibers grab a hold of the valve and pull down with all their might, which is very, very cute because it means that the door that would be opening and closing, which is trying to be blown out, has somebody tugging on it to help close it. What's elegant about this in the terms of the topology is that you don't want to wrap the entire heart like that because the mechanical strength of the tissue is very strong for forces applied along the fibers, but any force could pull the fibers apart. So each subsequent wrapping or each subsequent layer is at a slightly different angle. And there's about it's actually a little bit more than 90 degrees, maybe 100 or 120 degree angle change between the fibers on the inner surface of the wall and the outer. So in terms of a engineered composite, it's exquisitely done because all of the fibers start here, all of them end on the inside, and you hopefully don't have too many discontinuities as these fibers twist around and get themselves connected. Okay. We go down to 100 microns. There's the cardiac cell. As we'll see later, each cardiac cell looks like the state of Tennessee by design. And there's contractile machinery inside the cell, so at 10 microns we have the diameter of the cardiac cell, and you begin to see the actin-myosin hardware that's required to make the cardiac cell shorten when you get the calcium released, which is done electrically. At the scale of 1 micron, this is from a cover of Scientific American, it's actually not to scale, but this would be the tip of a glass micropipette, and when properly done, it can suck on to the surface of the membrane, and this channel is about two orders of magnitude bigger than it should be. It's 10 nanometers instead of, they're doing like 100, it's about a factor of 10 too big. This is an ion channel that controls the flow of ions into the cell, and with the patch clamp, you can suck on to the membrane and listen to the activity of a single gate letting ions in and out of the cell. At 100 nanometers, you start seeing the surface. You see the structure inside the cell. These are microtubules and other cytoskeletal elements that give the cell mechanical rigidity. At 10 nanometers, you're getting now to the level of the molecule. 5 to 10 nanometers is the thickness of the biological membrane, which is a phosphate group with a lipid tail. The lipid is hydrophobic, so that when you build the cell, the hydrophobic tails come together and form a lipid bilayer. So you have phosphate groups on either side and lipids in the middle. You have DNA, I think that's a sugar molecule. But again, at 10 nanometers, you're at the size of a protein. And in the case of cardiac tissue, these proteins, this hole is way too small, except that it must be drawn as being closed. You can think of a protein as something like a potato floating in this fatty soup of membrane. From the point of view of a physicist, the cardiac membrane is a planar accelerator that uses gradients of 10 to the 7th volts per meter to accelerate heavy ions to energies of 70 millielectron volts. Now, on some other work, which I'm not going to talk about, except if people want to discuss it later, 10 to the 7th volts per meter is a very, very strong electric field. You're very near the dielectric breakdown strength. And the trick is to figure out, in my mind, how to use this field to interact with other probes than the dyes that are being used, or use, for example, semiconducting nanocrystals to drive that field. So there are issues now of solid-state physics in trying to play games where you have access to fields of 10 to the 7th volts per meter. At the scale of a nanometer, you're about the size of the hole through one of these potatoes, and this is actually a neurotransmitter receptor. When the site is, this is the acetylcholine receptor, when the site is not bound, the door is closed. When the site is bound, the door is open and you allow ion flow. Similar things happen with other membrane channels. There's zillions of membrane channels. So, what we now see is, having worked our way all the way in, starting with this list of models, is we have two great extremes. The Einthoven triangle, which describes the heart as an electric dipole whose tip follows a locus of points that looks like that, and the ion channel, the kinetics of the single ion channel. And if you put a micropipette on this channel and listen quietly, you see quantized fluctuations in conductance as the channel is either open or closed. Some of the channels show intermediate states, so there might be four sublevels. But again, it's a stochastic quantum model at the scale of a nanometer and above versus the entire heart at the scale of 10 centimeters to a meter. It is there where you have the problem. The ultimate forward problem is going to be to take what you know about a single ion channel and predict the electrocardiogram from it. So, here we have a problem. An ion channel is 10 nanometers. There's on the order of one channel per square micron of cell membrane. A cardiac cell has 150 by 15 by 15 microns. That's 500 to 30,000 channels per cell. The heart is 10 centimeters in diameter. It's got 2 times 10 to the 14th channels. The body at a meter, you're talking about a 10 to the 8th ratio in spatial scales and a 10 to the 24th ratio in volumetric scales. So what you want to be able to do, and this is of tremendous clinical significance, is you want to be able to take a drug that you know how it acts on the single channel and ask yourself what happens when you apply it to a heart. This is Leon Glass's picture of a spiral wave, a tachycardia in the heart. What happens to the heart at this scale, and that's the dominant scale, when you affect the kinetics of a single channel at the molecular level? And there was a major clinical study that was terminated prematurely because they found that more people were dying from fibrillation with the antiarrhythmic drug than with the control. So the ultimate forward problem is to go to from channel to the whole heart, channel to the electrocardiogram. So let's see what that's involved. You take DNA sequencing. This is actually the sequence of amino acids for the KV1.5, a particular channel protein. It's a potassium channel protein in the heart. A friend of mine, Dirk Snyders, gave this to me. So you take this sequence, you put it in the DNA sequencer, and you assemble the strand of the protein that you're trying to model. You solve the protein folding problem and realize, I mean, the current state of the protein folding problem is they look at a segment and say, ah, yes, this is hydrophobic, this is hydrophilic, and you ask, well, how does it get wrapped together? Well, ideally, you come up with a way that keeps track of the beach towel model where you figure out how to assemble the channel so this is the channel closed and this is the channel open. And in a space-filling model, you can have similar issues of what is where. That's only the first part of the problem because you now have to get the kinetics. So in one of these channels that Dirk was working on, there were four, it was a tetramer, there were four identical subunits in the protein, each of which was governed by rate equations going from one conformation to another. And so you come up with the coupled rate equations to describe the dynamics of this protein that you have just successfully folded. And if you have done that, you should be able to predict the statistics of the stochastic behavior, channel open, channel closed, channel open, channel closed. And this is experimental data, but if you're doing the calculations right, you need to go from the DNA sequence through the folding to the rate equations to get to this point. There are a few unsolved steps there. Now, once you have done that, and you now have the kinematics of these proteins, you say, all we have to do, this is the piece of cake, all we have to do is build the heart. So a friend of mine, Matty Spock at Duke, took cardiac photographs of cardiac cells, glued them together. So he had 33 different flavors of cardiac cells, and he chose those designs because they gave him some ability to assemble hearts in chunks. So it's a self-similar problem. Here we have a whole pile of small states of Tennessee that give you one very large state of Tennessee. And given a model like that, you can then start sprinkling in different densities of very specific proteins that provide the connection of this cell to that. They're called connexions. They're proteins that have holes in them that are not gated that allow this cell to talk to that cell electrically through the insides as well as the outside. So now he has 20 or 30 cells in this and can start conducting experiments where he numerically stimulates this mesh of cells and looks at how the signal falls off with distance this way versus that way. And that's addressing some questions about how cardiac tissue behaves. Now, one of the simple questions that has already been demonstrated, which I think is extremely important, is a group, I believe in the Netherlands, took the kinematics of single channels and put them into a small population of cells, kind of like the one we saw, and predicted the voltages and currents as a function of time for each of these channels and the cells, and built together a population that represented that first relaxation oscillator in the right atrium, and showed that the statistical fluctuations at the level of the single channel led to fluctuations in the timing of the rate of the relaxation oscillator. And they essentially had, I think this was experiment and this was theory, one or the other. They were effectively showing that you could understand heartbeat variations in terms of statistics of single channels. And that means that effects at the level of the channel do affect things at the whole heart. Okay, so given the fact that you can now create models that represent a small patch of cardiac tissue. You say, fine, all we have to do is assemble them and take Spock's 23 or 30 cells and build the entire heart. And as the wavefront propagates through, that wavefront gives you the double layer that has impressed currents flowing across it and then ohmic currents flowing. And you should, in theory, be able to predict an episode of fibrillation. Now, here comes the problem. If you want to have these coupled partial differential equations describing each cardiac cell or collection of cardiac cells, you have to keep track of the number of variables. You have two potentials, the potential inside the cell, the potential outside the cell. We have anisotropies and electrical conductivity, mechanical stress and mechanical strain. There are volume fractions. There's what fraction of the volume of the little cell you're working on is inside the cell versus outside the cell versus the sarcoplasmic reticulum, which is where the calcium is stored, and what's the area of the membrane relative to the volume, because these membranes are not just perfect ellipsoids. They can be highly convolved in shape. You have sodium, potassium, sodium concentrations in two spaces, potassium concentrations in three, chlorides in two, calcium in three, ATP, acetylcholine, and effectively pH. The channels that go across the membrane, there are six of them that turn on and turn off. They require three variables, which is 18 variables each. You have currents that turn on but don't really turn off, so that gives you only two variables. There's some currents that flow forever. If you have to specify the strength, that's seven variables. You have pumps that keep all the biochemistry sorted out. So in round numbers, you have 81 variables for each element in your model of coupled partial differential equations. If you want the equations to be stable and give the frequency response that you see in cardiac tissue, you effectively cannot make your segments bigger than 10 microns on a side, which means the cardiac cell is 10 segments. It's 4 times 10 to the 10th segments per heart. We'll cut some corners and give ourselves only 50 currents, and we have 2 times 10 to the 12th variables per heart. If we do our steps as long as can be done with current algorithms stably, it's 5 microseconds per time step. If I want to simulate the 10 seconds of fibrillation, I have 2 times 10 to the 6th time steps, which is 4 times 10 to the 18th equation, which is about a micromole. So you start talking about solving micromoles or moles of differential equations. Now, I did this calculation once because I was at a cardiac conference, and a group were saying, shucks, we've gotten the channels. Why don't you folks just go calculate the electrocardiogram? And I did the back of the envelope calculation. A 25 megaflop workstation would take 46,000 years, and one teraflop workstation could do it in a year. The electrical bill for doing that with 1,000 Pentiums was about $300,000, and the cost of the Pentiums was $1 million. There's a problem with memory, because for this model you need something like 4 terabytes of memory or disk to store the model. When I did this calculation, I abandoned numerical simulations and started using an analog computer, which is a rabbit. Now, a rabbit is very good because the rabbit can solve 4 times 10 to the 18th simultaneous differential equations in real time. The only trouble is there's a difficulty with readout. But the rabbit, you're solving a tremendous number of differential equations. Okay, so the real issue comes one of cardiac spatial scales. And spatial scales, the 10 centimeter diameter of the entire heart is a crucial scale, or at least the 1 centimeter size of the reentrant pattern, because that scale sets the behavior of fibrillation. The nanometer pore of the gated channel going down to the sequence of proteins that form that channel are crucial. I don't have a view graph of it, but if you look at the cardiac action potential, you can find a particular channel affects that piece, a particular channel affects that piece of the signal. So the spatial scales do count from the nanometer, or at least the micron, all the way to the whole heart. Temporal scales, you have the 1 second heartbeat. These complex arrhythmias may have a repeating pattern that's many seconds long, but the protein channels are changing their shape in a nanosecond. So there are clear problems in this. So the challenge that I think is faced, not just in cardiology is where I happen to be working, but similar problems occur in neuroscience, is where you're trying to figure out how to span a factor of 10 to the 9th in time and 10 to the 24th in volume. And this is a non-trivial theoretical problem, which is why I'm now 100% an experimentalist. Okay, so just to give you a flavor of the kind of things I am worrying about, this is the picture I showed before of a spiral wave in the heart, and the electrocardiogram from that would be a very strange shaped tachycardia. So you can ask, how do you create this? Take a block of cardiac tissue, put an electrode along one line, one edge, and create a wave that moves across. This is the region where the currents are flowing. This is that little 1 millimeter thick wave front. There happens to be a centimeter or many centimeter region behind that is refractory for stimulation. That's why the waves are not solitons that can pass through each other. They're solitary waves that if two collide, they annihilate. So this is a region that is blocked propagation. So if I look a few milliseconds after the stimulus, I can have my sample with half of the sample refractory, unable to support activation. If I put a second electrode here and make that a very, very strong stimulus, it activates the entire lower half plane. If I apply this at that time, I'm in the neat situation where here is tissue that wants to be stimulated but can't because it's refractory. Here is tissue that is stimulated simultaneously so it can't propagate a wave. This is tissue that's ready to be stimulated, and so a wave is formed that moves into it. And by the time the wave gets to here, this tail has moved. And so you create the spiral wave, which is running around the intersection of these two contours, which is a phase singularity called a critical point. This was worked out a number of years ago, theoretically by Art Winfrey and experimentally demonstrated by groups at Duke and elsewhere. Now, it turns out that this is kind of the first order mode. You have one phase singularity. If instead you stimulate with electrodes, send the wave front across, here's the refractory tail, and hit it with the second wave, the second stimulus, in the middle as a point, it turns out the intersection of the red versus the hatched has two critical points, two phase singularities, and were this a three-dimensional heart, this would be a scroll wave wrapped around a filament. And this wave front moves out here, moves out, goes further out, comes around, bumps into itself, part of it goes out, part of it goes in, the part that goes in continues along, and the thing reenters. Now, Winfrey argued from topological grounds, and Brad Roth from a much more careful theoretical model, that in some of the strange cable models that I've been working with experimentally and theoretically, mostly with Brad as the theorist, there is a situation where if I stimulate anisotropic cardiac tissue here, I create an expanding wave where the tail is a horizontal ellipse. There are some peculiar anisotropies of cardiac tissue that said that if the second stimulus at this point is very, very strong, or just very strong, not very, very strong, it turns out you have this strange shape for the activation. And the net result is you have four singularities, which means you have a wave front that is essentially a scroll wave wrapped around a filament that connects this pair, and a scroll wave of the opposite sign that's wrapped around a filament that connects that pair, and it propagates out. You reverse the sign of the stimulus, and you get different patterns, different singularities that are giving a similar shape, propagating in the opposite direction. I'm going to talk more about this at the seminar tomorrow. So Mark Lynn in my group set out to make the measurements based on Brad's prediction, stimulate the heart, and this is the second stimulus. You make a wave front that's going this way. The wave front starts expanding out, eventually merges, starts coming together, gets closer together, bounces and goes back out. And you have a topology where you have rotations going like this, fourfold symmetry, and on this one with the opposite polarity, the rotations are the other way with fourfold symmetry. So you can take these movies, take differences between frames, and this is the wavefront. If you take these movies and convert them into the local phase in terms of you get a limit cycle, you can find the location in the limit cycle, convert a voltage map into a phase map, and there are 4 points where the singularities are very clear because at this point, all adjacent points have all possible phases.
How was this measured?
This is measured by putting a voltage-sensitive dye into the membrane so the fluorescence shifts with voltage, illuminating it with a laser and using a high-speed charge-coupled device camera. So you get movies of these wavefronts, and this is what the movie looks like. Then you take the movie and convert it into the phase plane, and you can get a phase movie. And given the phase movie, the creation of the phase movie was demonstrated first most elegantly by Rick Gray at Syracuse, now at Birmingham. You take the phase movie and you compute the topological charge of that, which turns out to be equivalent to taking the curl of the gradient of the phase, in other words, the curl of the wave vector, and you can find 4 singularities, 1, 2, 3, 4, with opposite charge, this being probably a right-handed and this being a left-handed, this pair being connected by a filament, this pair being connected by a filament in the other direction. I call these wavefront pairs for lack of another term, but this is a pair of connected filaments, this is a pair of connected filaments. And what we're working on one marvelous set of data we have is the trajectories of these filaments as a function of time. So this is X and Y and T. This is a filament pair, this is a filament pair. Yes. That's right. This is a filament pair. That's a filament pair. It turns out these two vanish simultaneously. And the hypothesis we have, we're not sure how to test it, is what happened is you have these pair of filaments. The pair of filaments get distorted and bump. And as soon as they bump, one of them snaps straight to form a stable pair, and the other snapped either to the front or the back and disappeared. Our frame rates aren't high enough to see that. But we have multiple examples of filaments, actually of singularities that disappear simultaneously, consistent with the conservation of topological charge. The trouble is that the easy one would be for the whole filament to disappear, but it's not that. It appears that it's pairs of filaments that are merging to cause them to disappear. Okay, so that's an overview of cardiac electrodynamics, and we can now open the floor to questions. The quatrefoil reentry, we are the first people to document as very cleanly. There have been studies in the animal lab that when we go back and look at them, published studies, that say, hey, these folks were seeing quatrefoil reentry. The difficulty in the published data, it's not clear. You can have these pairs of wavefronts, but the question is, are they synchronized? And we know these are synchronized. It's not clear that this is clinically important. Experimentally, it's extremely important because it's the only preparation I know that allows you to reproducibly create pairs of scroll waves that you can look at the interaction. The goal is to try to get the interaction potential between the filament ends or the filaments. I'm not sure the data is good enough to do it, but that would be the goal. You ask, you know, do they accelerate when they, you know, are they attracted or repelled? I'll talk more about that tomorrow.
Okay. We had a medical colloquium here about 10, 15 years ago, given by a Dr. Mandel from San Diego.
Okay.
And he seems to
I did want to know what the question is. You should say it out loud.
I'll repeat it when I.
All right, I'll
stand up. Here. To follow up. My question is the following. There was a colloquium given here by a Dr. Mandel from UC San Diego who was studying both heart function and also brain function in connection or trying to examine whether there was any connection to mathematical chaos theory. And in particular, I remember that the fibrillating state was a candidate of a chaotic state, and was attempted to analyze it in terms of the existing methodology. And so that's a long time ago. And my question is, since you mentioned fibrillation, has this turned out to be a fruitful direction of research?
Okay, so I think the question boils down to is chaos a good model for cardiac fibrillation? And I think the answer on that is still not known. The difficulty is that the data sets are rather short. I'm not sure that it makes all that tremendous amount of difference whether it's chaotic or not. It's worth thinking of this using the language of chaotic behavior. I'm not that knowledgeable about that myself. So the answer is that to date, there is no proof that cardiac fibrillation is chaotic. It's not totally disorganized. It's less disorganized than it thought. 10 years ago, people were not aware of these scroll waves that were interacting and shedding vortices. And so you would look at the heart and say, that looks chaotic. But in fact, it's really quite ordered. And so the questions of chaos become much more secondary in nature. It's not just chaotic electrical behavior. It's highly organized electrical behavior. But that doesn't mean that it still can't have chaotic properties. Okay. Does that answer your question?
There are organizing principles in chaotic behavior as well.
Yes.
And that's what Mandel was driving at the time.
But my impression from two folks that have looked into this at length is that the answer on fibrillation is still not out, and it's not clear whether it will ever really come in as to whether cardiac fibrillation is officially chaotic. Okay.
I'm wondering if there are other physical models for at least the topology that you found. You've alluded to fluid flow, and there are pattern-forming chemical reactions and so forth. Do any of them have the same pattern of singularities and filaments and so forth that you see in the heart?
Yes. The pattern-forming reactions, the most notable one is the BZ reaction that shows many of these phenomena. I don't think it has ever shown the quatrefoil reentry. Otherwise, it is an excellent analogy. And the differential equations that are used to describe that, Fitzy-Nagumo equations or two-variable oscillator models, would be used to describe either the BZ reaction. The trouble with cardiac is if you want to really match the physiology, you need more than two variables. But the analogies are excellent. And there are other systems that behave like this with spiral waves. So I'm not sure how many of the phenomena in cardiac tissue are unique to cardiac tissue, except that topologically they're not unique, but some of them because the shapes of the waveforms, the recovery characteristics. But the analogies are really excellent.
Professor Kugler?
You described the model of cardiac behavior, which depends on propagation in a nonlinear medium with time delay.
Yes.
Where does feedback come in? Does this give rise to feedback, or is there another feedback mechanism to keep the behavior?
There are at least, there are multiple layers of feedback. You can think of the propagating wave itself as positive feedback because it sends the wave out. In terms of reentry, you can think of it as a larger scale feedback that comes back upon itself. But in actual maintaining the heart in its normal rhythm, you have, for example, the elegant one is if the heart gets stretched by having too much blood in it, there is an intrinsic mechanism within the muscle that causes it to contract harder. So if you look at the work produced by the heart as a function of the volume of the heart, it's a line that goes up. So when you put too much blood into the left ventricle physically does more work to get the excess blood out. And that's the primary balancing mechanism that keeps the left and the right sides of the heart synchronized, so you don't pump all the blood into the lungs. Because if you try to pump all the blood into the lungs, the left ventricle says, I'm getting so much blood, I'll pump it out faster. And if the right ventricle doesn't get enough blood, it doesn't pump as hard. So you have this relationship, which is work versus volume, that goes up fine until you go into heart failure and then it rolls over. And as soon as it rolls over, you go into heart failure because you give your heart more work to do and it does less work. There are biochemical feedback mechanisms, which I don't understand, and there are also neurological feedback mechanisms. The heart is self-paced, but the adjustments of the rates are coming from neurological signals. So, I mean, it's an incredible feedback mechanism. Everything from the... And in the long-term case, for example, if you have an atrial tachycardia that where your atria are running too fast because of a reentrant rhythm, it turns out, which is not necessarily good, you can have a particular channel protein start being expressed at a higher rate, and the atrial cells change their electrical behavior. And this is positive feedback because it turns out that change in electrical behavior makes you more prone for atrial tachycardia. So if you have an atrial tachycardia, you want to correct it before it gets imprinted into your heart. So the feedback goes both ways, good and bad, and it's at every scale, from the expression of a single channel to the neural pathways going from the heart, the blood pressure receptors in your neck, for example, your brain, and going back.
And the nonlinear oscillation frequencies, where you can have mode locking, 2-to-1, etc. Is that a neurological, or due to time delay?
The mode locking is tied into the... On that one picture I showed, the wavefront going across with the refractory tail, it's the refractory tail that sets the mode locking, more or less. It's that you have this refractory period. And the length of that refractory period says that you can send a wave, and the second wave can't get through, but the third one can, and then you get a 2-to-1 block. I mean, that there's some exquisite... I mean, the clinical cardiologists in their journals have an arrhythmia of the month, and they put an electrocardiogram, and it's the most bizarre electrocardiogram you could ever talk about, and then somebody explains what that electrocardiogram was, and you have, five, six blocks. It does five beats, and then six beats, and then five beats, and six beats, and they figure out where it comes from. So they're bizarre arrhythmias. Okay.
On the other hand, I think, and perhaps oversimplifying, the average MD will take the ECG and count the little wiggle and make sure that the right number is there. How do you make a connection between the two?
Well, it turns out that clinical research-oriented clinical cardiologists are extraordinarily clever and are largely becoming molecular cardiologists. So the clinical cardiologists are worrying about, at least in the research environment, they are worrying about the expression of these channels and their properties. The difficulty that shows up, and this is everywhere in the biological revolution, is that as people understand the molecular level, the challenge is how do you go back out to the whole system? And there are people arguing that you have to invent new techniques, and both experimental and mathematical, to make the coupling from the sequenced genome to the functioning organism. And, I mean, Bill Bialik, who some of you know, gave a talk on neuroscience that essentially has the same message, is that it's very, very hard to go from the microscopic description to the macroscopic. And the current trend in medicine, in particularly research medicine, is to go very, very microscopic. So they're building knockout mice that have had one specific protein removed, and they're saying, well, what has this done to the physiology of the mouse? And, I mean, these are very hard problems. And this one clinical study that I referred to was a major embarrassment to the cardiology community, the antiarrhythmic community, because they had this drug already in final clinical studies, and they terminated it because people were dying faster. And it was because they didn't keep track of a particular mode tied into that refractory tail. And that led to an instability that if the person did actually fibrillate or go into an arrhythmia, while the probability of the arrhythmia was reduced, the damage that could be caused by it was increased. And it was in part a failure of, in a number of fronts, it could not be modeled today. In other words, that experiment cannot be done mathematically. It has to be done experimentally. I have a friend who's very good in this business in the Netherlands, and he has a laboratory for, he has a commercial laboratory that has a technician come in the morning, spends the entire morning putting rabbit hearts on perfusion systems, and has robots doing these experiments on rabbit hearts, literally using the rabbit heart as his analog computer. So he has probably 50 rabbit hearts running in the course of a morning, and they put a drug on, the heart fibrillates, the computer defibrillates it, they change the drug and keep going through this. And so they're doing mass screening of drugs using rabbits as parallel processing, highly parallel processing computers.
We're talking about the difficulty of doing essentially a measurement of the ECG, a couple of electrodes on the chest, I guess,
right,
to figure out what's happening inside. Is there, again, practically speaking, this work tell you there would be a better way to do it?
Yeah. No.
So we still stuck at
It depends on whether you want to be invasive. If you want to be invasive, you can do fine things. The lack of a unique solution to Laplace's equation means that you are not going to be able to solve the inverse problem and say, ah, this particular sodium channel has gone bad in this region of the heart, which is what you need to know. You need to know when you put a drug on that's binding to a particular channel that's putting a strange little kink in part of the in the electrical response of the cell. What is that, you know, did it happen? Did it bind? Mm-hmm. I mean, so in many ways the picture is kind of bleak, and that's why I say since the ultimate inverse problem doesn't have an answer, you have to work on the ultimate forward problem, which is to take the newfound knowledge at the molecular level and try to start working your way back out. And that's going to take a whole set of new tools.
The fibrillation and all these mechanisms, this is really macroscopic motion of the heart.
Yes.
Could you measure this by, ultrasonic visualization?
It turns out that in the past 5 years, the ability to do high-speed fluorescence imaging of the action potential wavefronts is a major advance. That's not done clinically because you can't see the heart. And the dyes are toxic, so they're not doing that in the operating room. In the electrosurgery operating room, which is now quite rare because it's done with catheters, they would put a sock around the heart that might have 500 electrodes to try to infer the pathway of activation. So these are fundamentally hard problems. The inverse problem, and people are still working on trying to solve approximations to the inverse problem, but the ultimate one that I've drawn is I drew it as the absurd extreme, is that you cannot do it.
Well, I know quite a few people came because they told me they were interested in practical problems as well. I see several postdocs that are constantly talking about the optimal heart rates and so on and so forth. And one of them is extremely shaken, very low heart rate. And so maybe we can start with that. Is that the optimal heart rate, the lower the better? Or?
I mean, I think there. Your abstract had a. I had put the final line on the abstract that said something to the effect that there'd be time for asking questions about how your heart works or doesn't. And Tony changed it to how to exceed the 2 billion heart rate limit. And I started thinking about that. And my first question is it possible to exceed the 2 billion heart beat limit?
So what is the standard deviation on that figure? That's the average.
I don't know.
I don't know.
Now it turns out that what's sobering about this whole business is if you ask why does the left ventricle have a thickness of a centimeter on its wall, and the right ventricle have a thickness of a couple of millimeters, it turns out the developmental biologists say they believe it is tied in to the number of pre-programmed cycles of mitosis that occur when the cells divide. And the cardiac cells divide to make thicker and thicker wall until the clock says stop. And in the case of the ventricular cells, they're programmed to make a thick wall. And the left ventricular cells are programmed to make a thick wall, and the right ventricular cells are programmed to make a thin wall. So what I don't know is the extent to which your heart is programmed to beat 2 billion times. And the first reaction is, my God, you should never exercise because it raises your heart rate.
Yes.
But the fallacy in that argument is that by raising your heart rate with exercise, you lower your heart rate when you're at rest. And so the integrated number of heartbeats may well be lower.
So is that mechanism understood? By raising it, you lower the resting heart rate?
Yes. Yes, in fact, I think it is understood because it's going to improve...
Just the muscle tone?
Your heart gets bigger. And so your heart will get bigger and stronger. So in thinking about your comment about extending the 2 billion, I think the answer is yes, you probably can extend the 2 billion, and what you should probably do is follow the American Heart Association recommendation, which is don't eat fatty foods and get exercise and don't smoke. And so I think the bottom line is that. Yeah. It depends. There are two kinds of failures. Sudden cardiac death is going to be fibrillation. And the great challenge is here you have a heart that is capable of 2 billion beats of normal rhythm where the atria fire, you propagate a wave, the ventricles fire, you propagate a wave, and the thing goes over again. That system can be made unstable. And the question is that you can fibrillate with electric shock a healthy, normal young heart. There are issues of whether large hearts fibrillate more easily than small hearts, and that's tied into the number of singularities you can fit on the surface. But it turns out that one of the issues of vortex shedding is that if you have a barrier and a wavefront comes up to the barrier and is blocked by the barrier, you now create two free ends, and each of those two free ends form a vortex. And what happens with aging is that the number of heterogeneities in the heart start increasing. And so I don't think this is terribly well understood yet, because just now people in a number of labs, including ours, are trying to understand the role of heterogeneities in the heart, electrical heterogeneities. And so people are at the point, they take a rabbit heart, they take a little slice and suture it back up, shock it and see what happens when the wavefront crosses the shocked region. But there's a whole issue of what spatial scale of heterogeneities are important. And a couple of years ago, people were convinced that the spatial scale was 100 microns. And there was an intense effort to try to find electrical heterogeneities that correspond to the junctions between two adjacent cells. And they could find the ends of a single cell. That was pretty easy. They could take a single strip of cells and find the junctions. But if they took a two-dimensional sheet with six cells wide, the heterogeneities averaged out. And so there's a question. There are heterogeneities in the heart. They are probably at the level of a millimeter, that these bundles. And as you age, you start putting fat and connective tissue between these bundles. And so the heart looks like lower quality meat. And what's worse than is if you ever have a heart attack, you have now made an island of inactivation. And then these singularities I'm talking about are functional singularities, where you are going around a phase singularity. If you have a heart attack, you can actually have a ring of dead tissue. And in the appropriate case, you can literally send a wave that just runs around this singularity. So in cases of atrial fibrillation, there is an operation called... In atrial fibrillation, you have these pathways where electrical activity is chasing itself around the atrium. And so they take the heart, cut it into squares, and sew the squares together. And that's called the... I think it's probably done with lasers. It's called the maze operation, where you try to make the region... If you can't make the heterogeneity small, make the regions very small. And so you just chop the heart up into little pieces and glue it back together again, and there's a connection, there's an insulating connection between sections. That seems a little frightening. So the answer is that, what was the question? Oh, how do people die? Oh, yeah, so it turns out that people will die because of reentrant arrhythmia. So classic sudden cardiac death is where you get sinus rhythm, goes into tachycardia, goes into fibrillation. And if you're defibrillated, either by a physician or put on CPR by someone walking down the street, or if you're lucky enough to have an inspired golf course in an inspired state that allows programmable electronic defibrillators to be used by lay people, you can get saved. And if you're saved once, you can get a cardiac defibrillator put in, which greatly increases your odds of surviving. The other mode of cardiac death is is heart failure, where you get into the problem where you had this work versus stroke volume, and you go over the top. And that's when your heart starts, then your heart starts enlarging. And it enlarges not by necessarily thickening the wall and becoming stronger, but by becoming physically larger. The pressures get higher and the muscle gets stretched and it doesn't contract as effectively. So there is there's an electrical death and there's a plumbing death. In the plumbing death, your lungs fill up with fluid because you can't pump the stuff around. So that's the other class of failure. And that's generally people who've had a heart attack may not die of the heart attack, but may die of the heart failure because of the damaged muscle or from age or circulatory disease.
Okay. Question back here. In the two-dimensional thing that you put a pulse here and the wave,
right.
There was a region that doesn't respond after the wave passed.
Right.
And does that depend on the voltage? The thickness of this thing?
On that picture, you had hatched and not hatched. Mm-hmm. And then you had red and not red. The height of red depends upon the strength of the stimulus. So the location, you can drive the singularity up and down by adjusting the strength of the second stimulus. And you can drive the singularity right and left by adjusting the timing. Okay?
Gary? I was just wondering, this is sort of $2 billion. $2 billion, you know, average heartbeats vary significantly when you sort of look at different animals?
No. It turns out that... No, it doesn't. There's been some very elegant classic studies by Kurt Schmidt-Nielsen at Duke where he's looked at that, and if I remember correctly, I can't remember the exact number, but if I remember correctly, the total number of heartbeats is about constant across all animals. And that's the one that's a little bit, that's why I'm not sure you can beat the 2 billion. So the trick is, use them wisely. What?
It's not the same for a car, is it?
Other questions?
Oh, Walter. Yeah, in an actual today's clinical electrocardiographic examination, you get information on a scale, on a spatial scale,
right,
of the order of whatever you want to call it, 10 centimeters, 1
right.
centimeter. If one tried very hard, what is the minimum spatial scale that one could get meaningful information?
That's a very good question. The question was the clinical electrocardiogram has a particular spatial scale. How much better can you do? Well, it turns out that the standard electrocardiogram that you go into the doctor's office, they put a wire on one leg, both legs, both hands, and several across the chest. They end up then coming out with a coordinate system. They combine these signals and effectively have the world's most overdetermined way to find an angle within 30 degrees. That's more or less the way the thing is working. Now, some groups put electrodes across the surface of the chest. This is not a standard clinical test. This is, again, it's more, it's done in some clinical places, probably... Case Western Reserve would be the place that would come to mind, where they and probably Utah, where they put 500 electrodes across the surface of the chest. That is probably heading towards the maximum useful density, because on some of these, the problems, if you did a singular value decomposition of multiple electrodes to try to get to a model, you quickly get to the point where the information is just not there. And it's not there because if this is your source, there's a spatial low-pass filter given to us by the Green's function in Coulomb's law. So the information is falling off as 1 over R squared. And you can't beat that filter. So you can try. In fact, the best thing to do is to take 500, maybe 1,000 electrodes on the surface of the chest and do an inward continuation to a solution of Laplace's equation. It's ill-conditioned, it's unstable, but there is a unique solution that goes from the surface of the chest to the surface of the heart. Now, you get a very nice picture of the surface of the heart. The trouble is that because of the lack of a unique solution to Laplace's equation, you cannot continue inwards into the region where there are the sources. So you can go to the surface of the heart, but no further in. So you can't distinguish, if this is the heart, you can't distinguish this wave front from that wave front, because you can't get the mathematics to work inside. If you look at the multiple expansions, it's, you know, R greater than or R less than kind of argument. And if you're ever inside the surface containing your sources, you're dead. You're not dead, but you can't do the arithmetic. Okay.
Okay, let me remind the audience that there's an informal seminar tomorrow on some aspects of the cardiac.
It's going to be on the issues of these reentrant pathways and these last couple of pictures.
Okay, well, let's thank the speaker again.